I'm Theo Greenlee, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUCB, where I work in on Alaska, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Security, climate change, environmental protection, sustainable economic development, and international cooperation and governance are the four pillars of the new 10-year national strategy for the Arctic region. The plan is a continuation of work started in 2013, but puts greater emphasis on some elements and acknowledges the growing problems caused by Russia's war in Ukraine. We'll discuss the future of Arctic safety, community resilience, and health today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Sneezing, aching, sweating, and coughing. Who has the time for this misery? You have the power to protect yourself and your community. Boost your defenses this season by getting the flu vaccine. Protect yourself and family. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. In the vast Arctic region, where climate change is affecting the land, water, and residents more than three times faster than other places in the world, what are the known challenges and opportunities for the future? And how reliable is the information about the changes that will come in the next decade and beyond? Today, we're talking with Arctic climate and policy experts. In the first half of today's program, we'll talk with Dr. Alondra Nelson, the Deputy Director for Science and Society at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Dr. Nelson is also a Deputy Assistant to the President. Welcome, Dr. Nelson.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you, Lori.
Wonderful to have you on. Also with us is Professor Larry Hinsman. Dr. Hinsman is the Assistant Director for Polar Sciences at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, and he is the Vice Chancellor for Research at UAF and has had a long affiliation with the university. Hello, Professor Hinsman.
Hello, Lori. Thank you very much. And actually, I am at OSTP now. I'm the Assistant Director for Polar Sciences, but I'm no longer the Vice Chancellor for Research at UAF.
I'm a
professor there, but now Nelia Bell-Hamer is the current VCR at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
All right.
But I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for helping us share this message.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for that clarification and correction. So you're still a professor at UAF, but no longer vice chancellor. Thank you. And later in the program today, we'll be joined by Ambassador David Balton. Ambassador Balton is the executive director of the Arctic Executive Steering Committee. And you can also join our conversation today. Have you reviewed the national strategy document? It's linked on our website at today's Talk of Alaska post. What are your biggest concerns for the Arctic's future? You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Dr. Nelson, I want to start with you. Tell us about your role at the Office of Science and Technology Policy. I'm interested in your title as the lead for science and society. Talk about what that means. How do you mesh science and communities together?
Yeah, that's great. That's a perfect question. So, at the Office of Science and Technology Policy, we sit inside of what's called the Executive Office of the President, and we offer advice to the president. And, this is an administration that believes that science and technology have a lot of potential to improve our lives, but it must be paired with the wisdom of local people, what people know about their lives and about their communities. And so we make an effort in the work that we do at OSTP to think both about the science and society side, on science and technology side, and the technical pieces, but also understand that that's got to be done with local communities, and that we need to understand the social implications of the work that we do as well. So the office that we, OSTP, has several different divisions: energy, climate and environment, health, technology, and including the team I lead. And our team kind of cross-cuts all the other teams, because the social issues are a large piece of the work that we do, regardless of what the particular technology is or the science is. And we want to ensure that the way that we're using innovation advances democratic values, and that it also is, you know, it's a very powerful tool for benefiting all of us if we think about issues of fairness and equity in the way that we are designing our policy, including Arctic region policy and our science and technology as well. And so part of, you know, when I was in Alaska a couple of weeks ago, traveling with Dr. Hensman and others from our team, and it was really thinking about the whole, you know, Alaska, as you said, and the Arctic region really is this extraordinary microcosm of, you know, the great challenges that we face as we with climate change, and also some of the most extraordinary innovation in the science and technology space as people try to have more resilient communities. And so this visit was really an opportunity to engage in sort of the work that we do, but on the ground and communities. And I know you're going to talk to Ambassador Bolton about the new national strategy for the Arctic region. But I want to pull a few threads from that to tell you how it really sort of is consistent with all of our work. And so, you know, this Arctic strategy, we really engaged lots of different communities. We talked to people, we talked to experts, of course, but we also talked to policymakers, local and federal, Alaska Native tribes. Indeed, on my first day, my first two meetings actually in Alaska and Anchorage were at the American Federation of Natives meeting, where I gave some remarks about the Biden-Harris Arctic strategy, and also a meeting with elders and leaders from the Northern Bering Sea area. And so, you know, the Arctic strategy and the part of the reason why we were there in Alaska was really that our work can't be done well and effectively if we are not engaging the communities to who it matters most. And so that was partly what we were trying to do. I had, in addition to visiting AFN and meeting with folks in Anchorage, we visited the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program at the University of Alaska at Anchorage. We visited the Anchorage Museum and learned how tribal communities are engaged in Arctic preservation and Fairbanks. We visited the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, as well as the Cold Climate Housing Research Center, which are just, you know, leading world-class examples of innovation and adaptation as we face climate change challenges. So the work that we do in the office really cross-cuts so many of the issues and challenges and opportunities that are taking place in Alaska. And we were really honored to be able to, including some of the security challenges that I know that you'll talk about with Ambassador Bolton. And we were really honored to have the opportunity to visit with you and your communities for a week earlier this year.
Well, thank you for getting us started off there on this conversation, Dr. Nelson. When you're talking about consultations, especially with people who are in the area of concern, as you know, this has been a shift in thinking and in policy considerations in recent decades, from a time when government would say, you know, make a plan somewhere far away and say, here's how it's going to be in these areas. Here's how we're going to do construction and other things. And we see the fallout of some of those past decisions that just don't work as well. A cookie cutter design that might work well in the Midwest does not work well in the Arctic. Talk a little bit about the importance of community involvement, especially as it relates to climate change. The voices of the people who are directly affected, who don't have any political power, who aren't really contributing much at all to the weight of the rapid changes that are happening to their communities, but are suffering the effects of them, and how that both helps make the policies more correct for those communities, but also the challenges that it may bring in trying to meet the test of standards for all people in those communities.
What an extraordinary and important question. I would add to your question, in the state of Alaska itself, right, we see that there's not one solution for the challenges that communities are facing there. I think that we have learned lessons. I mean, this is certainly in the work that we're doing in the Biden-Harris administration, because we have in part so many, not only Native Alaskans, but you know, wider Indigenous leaders in government, we are very clear that our policy work is, you know, we're working in a tradition that sometimes we got it really wrong. And sometimes we got it wrong on purpose. And if we want to get it right, that we need to engage communities in this work. And so we have widespread consultation throughout our work. I mean, and a particular piece of the work is on Indigenous knowledge and incorporating, including partnering with Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous communities in our policymaking work. And so we've been involved in consultation with tribal leaders for well over a year. And, you know, we're hoping to announce at the Tribal Nations Summit at the White House, which is the November 30th and December 1st, which I was delighted to be able to announce at the Alaska Federation of Natives Conference, that we're going to have federal policy, federal guidance that shows federal agents and departments how to elevate Indigenous knowledge in their work and federal research and grant making and in decision making processes. And this is a real sea change, and we're really proud of this work. And of course, but we also understand that it's going to take continued consultation. So you don't just say we're going to do consultation and we're going to elevate and partner with Indigenous knowledge in our work and then sort of stop. It is an ongoing process. It's an ongoing collaboration and an ongoing learning process for folks in government like us with local communities. One of the more extraordinary things that we saw on our trip was the diminution, the recession of the Exit Glacier at Kenai Fjord. And you know, what that means for communities all around, including for tourism, frankly, you know, so there's obviously challenges around flooding you know, eroding coastlines, diminishing sea ice, thawing permafrost were some of the things that we experienced when we were in Alaska and got to see, witness firsthand, and sort of see firsthand the implications for people's lives about the things that we think about often at a higher kind of more abstract policy level. But even, you know, tourism and people's lived experiences in lots of different ways are being deeply impacted. And so we can't, as your question suggested, Lori, we can't do cookie cutter policymaking. And, you know, I think the challenge for government in this moment is to both be attentive to local communities' needs and also their wishes. I mean, in the space of climate change, as you know, just in Alaska itself, there are communities that are facing rising coastlines, some of which want to try to stay and some of which want to try to migrate to different places. And government's job, you know, needs to be able to help people, communities, to do that however they decide, be that through some of the extraordinary, you know, housing innovation, as we saw at the Cold Climate Housing Research Center, or through, you know, using resources like the bipartisan infrastructure law to help people move if they choose to.
Thank you, Dr. Nelson. If you're just joining us, today's discussion is on the future of the Arctic, the needs, the concerns, the opportunities, and we'll also be talking later in the program about the new national strategy for the Arctic region. On the line with us right now is Dr. Alondra Nelson. Dr. Nelson is the Deputy Director of Science and Society for the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Also with us is Dr. Larry Hinsman. Dr. Hinsman is the Executive Director of the Interagency Arctic Research Policy Committee. And in just a bit, we'll be joined by Ambassador David Balton, who is the Executive Director of the Arctic Executive Steering Committee. You can join our conversation if you have questions or comments statewide. The number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Hinsman, thank you for your patience. I want to get you in here now. You've been teaching at UAF for decades as a civil and environmental engineer, and in recent years as vice chancellor for research, although you're not doing that work currently. You're also working with Dr. Nelson's office at the White House now. Talk about your work in polar science. What are you researching, and how does it help shape future policy?
Well, thank you for that question. And you're right, I've been involved in Arctic research for over 40 years now. I've worked all across Alaska and throughout the whole circumpolar Arctic. And for many, many years, we were really focused on understanding the Arctic, the processes occurring there, how the Arctic affected the environment in the lower 48 and other temperate regions. And just in the last couple of years, we're really trying to take all that understanding, that focus, and try and understand how it affects the people of the Arctic. And so what we want to do is we want to take what we know, take what we can learn, and see how we can help how we can address the challenges that are affecting Arctic communities. And so we really are trying to shift our focus to take on, as Dr. Nelson just described, you know, the understanding, the interactions of science and society. So what we want to do is we want to take what we can do and address the challenges that you read about on the front page of the Anchorage Daily News or the Fairbanks News Miner. What do we need? What do communities need to thrive in this changing environment?
And along those same lines, you've been teaching, as we noted, and researching environmental science, climate change, the Arctic. How has the focus of your work changed through the decades as the understanding of climate change modeling and science has grown?
Well, it has really been remarkable, and it's something that you can't really see day to day. But looking back, like I said, I've been doing this 40 years. Looking back over the decades, we really see the shift, the paradigm shift in the way we do science. In that previously, we were looking at, you know, water migration across the thermal gradient, or we were looking at little microprocesses and trying to understand how the environment responded. And now we're really taking much more of a systems approach, in that we want to see how, you know, how one change in the system affects the others. So, for example, how the loss of sea ice affects the ecosystems around the whole Arctic, and how that affects infrastructure, and then how that affects communities. And so we're taking a much broader perspective to try and understand, you know, how our societies can do better, how they can thrive, how they can continue to grow and remain sustainable as the system around them is changing.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Hinsman. Dr. Nelson, I want to get back to you for a moment here. You were previously the Dean of Social Science at Columbia. You were talking earlier about engaging lots of people, policy experts, climate scientists, Alaska Native folks that live in the Arctic. When you think about the indigenous communities there in the Arctic and the growing needs as the climate warms, what do you think it will take to ensure there is equality and representation for future policy considerations? It seems to me that goes beyond just asking people or consulting with them about what they think is needed for the future. When it comes down to actually creating policy, how can you ensure that those voices are included?
That's such an important question. You know, as your question implies, Lori, it has to go well beyond good intentions, and we need to have processes like, you know, Indigenous consultation, but also the way that we approach research and policymaking needs to really move into a space of co-production. We need to actually take the democratic principles that we think about at often at a very high level. We think about the founding ideals of our country and think about what those mean in the in local government and federal government and how we live that out and how we do research and development and policymaking. So we've been also very engaged in our work and understanding that communities, community-based science and community perspectives, and some of this comes, as your question suggests, out of my trajectory as a social scientist, as a sociologist of science and technology, and knowing how important it is to engage in community-based participatory research and some of the work we do. But it's also the case that government, the federal government, is increasingly finding ways to offer communities ways to be engaged in science. And that's not just, here's some money so you can work with, name your federal department. It is really meaningfully asking communities to shape questions, to pose the questions that they want answered, to be at the table as questions are posed, as research grant programs are developed. Many of the things that we need to know about climate change, we quite, there's a lot, Larry's been doing, Dr. Hunt's been incredible work in the polar sciences. So we need to understand thawing permafrost. But as he suggested, we also understand that we need to be partnering with communities to understand what the implications of that is, what's that of the, for their lives? What does it mean for the foundations of homes? What does it mean for water supply? What does it mean for air quality? And we in government, local or federal government, can't know that without engaging communities about what's important for them. And so I think that we should, one of the things that we can appreciate about the Arctic strategy and the way that it was done, about a lot of the important priorities with regards to the Arctic and Alaska communities that really got underway on the first day of the Biden-Harris administration, is that we appreciate that we don't know it all. We don't even know the half of it. And that we need to begin to create small d democratic government that constantly, continuously engages people and not just, after the facts, having conversations, which is, a little bit of what your question suggested, but from the very beginning in an ongoing and sustained and respectful and democratic way in the work of governance again and again, every day and every day. And it's hard because it's much easier in some ways to govern from the top, to regulate from the top, to create policy from the top. But at a time when we've never had more pressing issues, at a time when we've never been needed more to work across communities, to work across the aisle on these big national and global issues, we really need to re-examine how we do the work of government and to make it as democratic and inclusive as we possibly can. And I also think it fundamentally means redefining what we understand knowledge to be, useful knowledge, meaningful knowledge, what we understand innovation to be. One of the phrases that we use here in our work, and that is part of some of how we're framing the budget guidance that we're giving to the federal agencies, is the phrase innovation for equity. Alaska Native communities, the United States, communities all over the United States are exemplars of innovation, creativity, discovery, and dynamism. And how do we mobilize that energy, that brilliance, and that creativity and to creating different pathways that are more equitable and inclusive? And so, I don't have, Lori, lots of answers, but I think we need to pose the question again and again to every science and policy, endeavor that we're doing and understand that asking different questions with different people at the table from the very beginning will create different outcomes.
Well, and as you noted, it might be easier to just be top down with directives, but we have seen evidence that when you incorporate the people who have knowledge going back thousands of years in a particular place, that knowledge is science, and that can lead to much better outcomes in the future, which also translates into money being spent in a much more efficient way. So I imagine it is a lot more work, but much better better thought out work when all community members are included. In our last couple of minutes here, Dr. Nelson, what other research projects or plans does the Office of Science and Technology Policy have for the Arctic region?
I might turn to Larry on that. I mean, I will say, just so you're aware, there's a few different kind of Arctic strategy pieces that are sort of up and running that OSTP plays an important role in. But I will turn to Larry to sort of flesh those out. So sure. You mentioned the body that Ambassador Bolton works with. So there's the Interagency Arctic Research Policy Commission. We have the Arctic Executive Steering Committee. We've got this, as I mentioned, Indigenous Knowledge Initiative that you will hear much more about at the Tribal Nations Summit, which takes place later this month. And then you'll probably, I hope that you will call, but I hope that your listeners will look up the Northern Bering Sea Climate Resilience Area. There was an executive order in the first week of the administration on that. So the administration has really prioritized Arctic peoples, livelihoods, resilience, economic opportunity, understanding their problems with economic insecurity, with food insecurity, and that these sort of all sit in the bigger context of the geopolitical conversation that I know that you're going to have with Ambassador Bolton. So we're thinking about all of those things. Indigenous issues, Alaska Native issues are a central part of the work that we're doing here, and we're immensely proud of that work.
Well, thank you so much. It was fantastic to have you join us for the first half of today's program. And Dr. Hinzman, do you want to follow up there before we take a break and talk a little bit about other research plans and projects that the office is undertaking that you are involved with?
Absolutely. I'm really pleased to see the interest on the national level and just international levels with Arctic, all things Arctic, and there's just so much going on right now. And OSTP has a lot of initiatives that we're moving forward. So the IARPIC, the Interagency Arctic Research Policy Committee, did release the Arctic Research Plan about a year ago in December of 2021. We've been working for the last few months on the implementation of that Arctic Research Plan. We've had a tremendous engagement from the state of Alaska and from the people in Alaska and the communities, and Indigenous perspectives have been incorporated. And there's been four priority areas that we're really working on, and those are community resilience and health, Arctic system interactions. So community systems and health or community resilience and health is to really understand the well-being of the communities and strengthening through research and developing tools, a better understanding of the social and natural and build systems in the Arctic to try and help maintain their sustainability. Arctic system interactions is to really understand the role of the Arctic in the global climate systems. So what role does the Arctic play in affecting storm trajectories, wildfire possibilities and probabilities, and just what? How does the role affect the global climate system? And the third priority we're really working on is sustainable economies and livelihoods. And so, as I mentioned, what we're trying to do is we're trying to address the challenges that we read about in the newspapers. And so sustainable economies and livelihoods, there's a great deal of science that is needed and can help improve the community's ability to thrive in this changing environment. And so we're really focusing on collaborating with the state of Alaska, collaborating with communities to try and address some of those challenges. And finally, the fourth priority we've been focusing on is risk management and hazard mitigation. And what we want to do there is try and improve the quality of life through research that improves the understanding of disaster risk exposure and sensitivity to hazards and adaptive capacities. And a great example of that is, unfortunately, the tremendous typhoon that hit Western Alaska a month ago. And so what we're trying to do is we've been working with the agencies that are addressing that and trying to understand the research needs that can help us better prepare into the future. And I will stop there. Thanks.
Thank you so much for really helping us better understand all that's underway and being worked on for the future of the Arctic. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, We will be joined by Ambassador David Balton, who is the Executive Director of the Arctic Executive Steering Committee. I want to say thank you to Dr. Alondra Nelson, Deputy Director of Science and Society for the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, for being on with us for this first half of the program. Dr. Nelson has to leave us now, but Dr. Hinsman will stay with us with Ambassador Balton when we come back after a short break as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Voting in the general election? Here are key deadlines you need to know. First, in-person voting begins on October 24th. Want to vote absentee? You must request your ballot by October 29th. Last is Election Day. You must vote or submit your ballot by November 8th. Visit elections.alaska.gov to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Elections.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about the future of the Arctic region and the new 10-year national strategy for the Arctic region that was released recently. On the line with us today are Dr. Larry Hinsman, Executive Director of the Interagency Arctic Research Policy Committee, and Ambassador David Balton joins us now. Ambassador Balton is the Executive Director of the Arctic Executive Steering Committee. Hello, Ambassador Balton.
Hello, Lori. Thanks for having me on your show.
Thank you so much for joining us. I want to dive in here in the strategy document. Give us a little historical context for this national strategy for the Arctic region. This is a follow-up to the 2013 plan, correct?
Yes, that's right. Soon after President Biden came to office, the feeling was that we needed to update the 2013 strategy. Enough had changed in the intervening years that some new ideas were warranted. When we began the process, one focal area was about climate change. The Arctic warming had accelerated since 2013 and was already having, as you know, profound consequences in the region. And we needed a new strategy to help us grapple with those changes. And then as even last year, I would say there were geopolitical changes occurring in the Arctic, different from the situation in 2013. And then, of course, before we released the strategy, Russia initiated a full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Russia being the largest Arctic country, then required us to reassess our relations with Russia and relations with others in the Arctic. So yes, we have issued a new strategy, essentially to update or replace the 2013 strategy.
The plan, you mentioned Russia's invasion and war against Ukraine. The plan says it may be possible to resume cooperation with Russia under certain conditions. What would those conditions be?
Well, certainly conditions very different from the ones we see today. Currently, the war in Ukraine, Russia's actions there make it virtually impossible to cooperate on a government-to-government level with Russia on most anything. And this is not only the view of the U.S. government, but all the other governments in the Arctic and many others outside the Arctic as well. There is the hope that someday we will be able to resume cooperation with Russia. I won't speculate on how the war in Ukraine will end or when it will end. I will say it will take a long time, I think, to rebuild the sort of trust that is necessary to underlie cooperation in the Arctic or really anywhere else.
All right. Thank you. If you're just joining us, we have on the line with us Ambassador David Balton. He is the Executive Director of the Arctic Executive Steering Committee, and Dr. Larry Hinsman, Executive Director of the Interagency Arctic Research Policy Committee. We're discussing the future of the Arctic and the new national strategy for the Arctic region. You can join our conversation statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. In the Anchorage area, you can call the local number 550-8422, 550-8422, or email talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's go to the phones now for just a moment. Merrick is in Fairbanks. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my phone call. This question would be offered to any of your guests, and maybe in particular to Ambassador Bolton. Right now today, the global CO2 levels, I think, around 414 parts per million, very, very high levels, and they continue to grow. But the two elephants that are in the room that we don't seem to be talking about as we think about global CO2 levels is, A, the global overpopulation problem. We're going to be at 8 billion people in the next couple of weeks. We're adding roughly 200,000 people per day to the human population. So in just 4 days' time, we're adding more people to the global population than exists in the entire state of Alaska. So that's something I don't hear the Biden administration talking about. The other part of this is, the other elephant is, China is by far and away the world's biggest CO2 emitter. And, you know, they'd like to trade with us, but they continue to, you know, build things like coal-fired power plants without consequence. And, you know, the question I would pose, if you want to trade with the United States and you're a country like China, you know, maybe the United States needs to be saying to the Chinese, look, get your CO2 emissions in check, or you don't get to trade with the United States.
All right, so you're just looking for some feedback on those thoughts?
Absolutely. And one last point, you know, that little that young gal, Greta something or another, she keeps talking about and criticizing the global efforts because global efforts don't seem to amount to very much. And I've seen this firsthand. You know, there was a big Arctic summit on CO2 levels about 5 or 6 years ago in Fairbanks, and we saw all the big jets show up from all around the world because all the people that were going to supposedly solve the problem thought it was in their best interest to fly in big four-engine jets like the Russians did, or the U.S. State Department came in on their own 737. And, you know, every time you have these global conferences with the people that ostensibly are there to solve the problem, they're not demonstrating by their own actions that they care very much about how much CO2 they're emitting. So just any of these thoughts that your guests want to discuss, I'd appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for the call, Merrick. Ambassador Bolton, you want to take a shot at that? And then maybe Dr. Hintzman can follow up.
Yeah, I can get it started anyway. Thank you, Merrick, for those points. You are certainly right that climate change in the Arctic and globally is we're at crisis levels. Nations are meeting right now as we speak in Egypt, actually, to once again try to build a greater consensus about how to attack this. You're also correct that China is the largest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions at this moment. It is also true that historically the United States has been the largest emitter over time. But unlike China, we are working hard to reduce emissions of our greenhouse gases. And thanks in part to some legislation that was, that's been passed, we actually are bringing our emissions level down. On a per capita basis, though, we still are a greater emitter of greenhouse gases than China is. It's obvious to me that we are going to need to change the way we live, the way we heat our buildings, the way we transport ourselves and our things around. You're right about that. In the Arctic, there are many places, including but not limited to Alaska, where the economies are still heavily dependent on fossil fuels. And that the world is moving away from that, maybe not as quickly as we ought to. But if we're going to do so successfully in places like Alaska, we're going to need to build a new kind of economy, a greener economy, a place where people can find jobs and produce and provide for their families while allowing us to continue the path toward net zero emissions. Larry, anything to add?
No, that was, yes, Dave. That was a good response, David. So thanks for that. It's a great question, Merrick. And all I can say is I agree with you. This is something that really requires action on all our parts. And that is a message that's really being repeated at the COP meetings that David was just talking about and is resonating across the globe. So the population growth is a huge challenge that is so difficult to address. One of the things that the Biden administration is doing, though, is we are really trying to improve innovation, improve technology, to address, to shift our use of energy, so to reduce the greenhouse emissions, to maintain the economy, maintain the sustainability, maintain the lifestyle, but change the emission capacity so that those are reduced, and so that we can have a national impact and a global impact on reducing the greenhouse emissions. This is something that's going to take action on every single person's part, but it also takes national approaches, and including, as you described, including from China, including from the United States, including from the other industrialized nations. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Well, thank you both for those responses. And I want to talk now about the plan itself. It's not a long document. It's just 15 pages. There are four pillars that sort of line out the areas of importance and concern. And the first pillar is related to security. Was that always the plan, or did that move up in prioritization after Russia started the war in Ukraine? Ambassador Bolton.
The idea of having four pillars, one of which is security, was part of the plan from the start. What changed was some of the language used in that pillar. The Arctic, I should say, is still, at least in my estimation, a low threat region. The prospect of actual armed conflict in the Arctic is still very low compared to many other places in the world. That said, I think the Arctic has become a more dangerous and less cooperative region as a result of Russia's actions. We have benefited for most of the period since the end of the Cold War in a fairly cooperative, rules-based order in the Arctic that we've built up over 25 years. Russia's actions fly in the face of a rules-based order, and we are worried about the Arctic. And we need to take a number of steps, and you'll see them laid out there, to secure our interests there, to protect our homeland, to defend our interests in the Arctic on a somewhat more urgent basis than we saw before.
Pillar number two references climate change and environmental protection. It says the federal government will work with the state on building resiliency, working to reduce emissions from the Arctic. Talk about what's meant here. The people living in the Arctic do not contribute much, but thawing permafrost does. How can that be reduced or mitigated? That's going on right now, correct? And so what could possibly help in that regard?
First, to agree that the thawing of the permafrost is a huge problem, and it's a problem that is not well reflected in climate models, at least until quite recently. Emissions from thawing permafrost around the circumpolar region could add up to another major polluting country, the equivalent of another major polluting country in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, both carbon dioxide and methane. There is no way to stop permafrost from thawing other than by cooling the planet overall. There's no magic solution. One thing we can do is understand the prospects of permafrost thaw better than we do know. There is actually a large effort underway now to study permafrost thaw so that we have a better handle on just how much the emissions from thawing permafrost need to reflect in what scientists call our carbon budget, the budget within which we need to stay if we're going to meet, for example, the Paris Agreement targets.
All right, thank you. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Ethel is in Kenai. Hello, Ethel. Ethel, are you there? Oh, maybe
can
we...
Can you hear me?
Oh, there you are. Hello, yes.
Yeah, thank you for this. One of the frustrations that I have had for the last couple of years is the disconnect between all of the scientists, the strategists, the Defense Department, and climatologists, and the new research centers in Fairbanks and everything else, and the way that climate change is affecting the Alaska Native peoples of the North. The impact is immediate upon us. We are losing our subsistence resources. We are helpless to defend against the crumbling of the Arctic, the coastlines, and we keep pleading for help to defend against climate change impacts. I do not hear ever one word about whether or not we are to become climate refugees, as the scientists and the policymakers at the state and federal levels debate this, that, or the other, because for us it's immediate. We are living it. We are not think tanks. We have to get our winter resources taken care of, and we cannot. At the same time, the Defense Department is spending considerable sums debating this, that, and the other against Russia and China. And so I just get really frustrated. It's easy enough to just, let's redirect a strategy. Let's look at this in terms of climate change and how it's going to affect the Arctic for the next 20 years. Let's pour some more into a science center in Fairbanks. I just get really frustrated because there are thousands of people living in Alaska, Canada, and points farther east that are experiencing such drastic life changes, and there is no adaptation, accommodation.
Ethel, you feel like there's not action happening fast enough on the ground? Is that your concern? Is that adaptation and mitigation is not happening as quickly as people need for it to happen?
Well, exactly. In the meantime, all the federal and state researchers are busy in their own spheres of research. It's just really frustrating to realize that, are our people going to be starving? Are we going to have to continue with more typhoons and everything else, and who's going to absorb the cost of rebuilding and reconstructing while everybody else is in comfortable, office chairs debating this and that.
Okay. Thank you so much, Ethel. We're running out of time with today's program, and I want to give our experts a chance to respond, but we do need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear from Ambassador Bolton and Dr. Hinsman about these frustrations, about action not happening quick enough for people who are every day living with the effects of climate change in their communities as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University offers degree programs with life-friendly, flexible scheduling and course delivery options grounded in real-life experience. Alaska Pacific University offers innovative programming in nursing, counseling, psychology, outdoor and environmental public health, and more. Financial aid is available. Advance your career with APU today. Learn more and apply now at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Sneezing, aching, sweating, and coughing. Who has the time for this misery? You have the power to protect yourself and your community. Boost your defenses this season by getting the flu vaccine. Protect yourself and family. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the future of the Arctic, the new national strategy for the Arctic region. And on the line with us, we have Ambassador David Balton, the Executive Director of the Arctic Executive Steering Committee, and Larry Hinsman. Dr. Hinsman is the Executive Director of the Interagency Arctic Research Policy Committee. And before the break, we heard from Ethel, a caller, who was expressing, I think, the sentiment that likely a lot of people who are living in communities that are being affected every day, having their food security affected, having the ways of life that they have lived for thousands of years and had assurance in how to do those things, change dramatically. And she was expressing the frustration that a lot of people may feel about it's not happening fast enough, that there's new studies, there's new research, there's people visiting to see what's happening, but they're looking for action. Ambassador Balton, how do you respond to that frustration?
It's a frustration I share, and it's certainly one I've heard many times, the one that Ethel has voiced. She is right that the people, particularly in coastal communities in Alaska, but not only in those communities, are sort of on the front lines of climate change. Here is one thing to grab onto as a possible new model, though. Dr. Nelson, in the first half of the show, referred to something called the Northern Bering Sea Climate Resilience Area. This is a part of the Bering Sea that has been placed off limits to oil and gas development. But more importantly, what has been created is a new way in which the federal government and representatives from the local communities are working together to address the interests of the local communities themselves. There is a group of federal agencies led by Department of Homeland Security and Department of Interior and NOAA, but many others as well. And representatives from these communities have formed themselves into a tribal advisory council. We are meeting now to address their needs based on their agenda. And the two first things that we've grappled with that just began this year are the food security crisis brought on by the poor returns of salmon to the Yukon-Kuskokwim River system, and also disaster preparedness and response, which was brought into sharp relief by the experience of the most recent typhoon, Typhoon Mirbok. So we're hoping that action can be achieved more quickly this way in partnership between local people and the federal government.
I want to talk a little bit about what's already happening in the Arctic. Shipping is already increasing through that region. There is little to no infrastructure to handle search and rescue and a host of other security and environmental concerns related to vessels transiting through. Russian men showed up on St. Lawrence Island recently, fleeing Putin's military recruitment. What do you see as the most urgent needs to address in this regard to keep Arctic residents safe, but also to make sure it's not their burden to deal with a shipping crisis? You know, in the early 2000s, we saw a terrible ship disaster out by Unalaska when a vessel called the Selandang Ayu broke apart and crew members died. Fortunately, the load on that vessel was just soybeans, but it could have been any number of, you know, dangerous chemicals or who knows what. What is that burden in itself is looming large for folks who live in that region and would want to help if there was a disaster. What is the thinking along those lines in particular?
So one thing I should note is that while shipping in the Arctic in and through the Arctic had been increasing over the last decade or more, one knock-on consequence or effect of Russia's war in Ukraine has actually been a reduction in Arctic shipping by other nations' vessels through Russian waters. Again, how long that continues, we don't know. But the prospects for disasters at sea are still very real. And you're right to say that individually, the nations of the Arctic are not well equipped or prepared to deal with major disasters. Before the war in Ukraine, the eight nations of the Arctic region actually produced a marine oil pollution preparedness agreement. actually led those negotiations along with a Russian counterpart back several years ago. And the idea was that we would cooperate with one another in the event of a major disaster to try to help clean it up and protect the local communities and people. Whether we can continue to cooperate with Russia on matters like that in the current moment is a real question. Mm. We can at least continue to cooperate with other nations in the Arctic in dealing with this, but we also need to step up our own game. And one thing that we are trying to do, or moving forward to do, is to build out the port in Nome, Alaska, to become a deep water port from which it will be possible to house more resources, ships and other resources that could be deployed in the event of a major spill or other disaster in that region.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes left here, and I'd like to try to get a little response from both of you, kind of hearkening back to Ethel's frustration about how quickly things are or are not happening. The UN climate summit called COP27 is underway in Egypt right now. Russia, inflation, and world economies still recovering from the pandemic are challenging aspirations of reducing fossil fuel use. A recent article in The Hill noted that because of spiking fuel prices and European supply problems, Germany restarted out-of-commission coal plants over the summer. And the U.S. and other nations have worked to ramp up natural gas exports. The president called on American corporations to pump more domestic oil. There is also some movement toward more renewable energy, but an AP article cited the UN Secretary General as saying at the COP27 conference, cooperate or perish, and using some very strong language about how urgent this need is. What do you expect to come out of this summit regarding the future of energy stability and real progress?
I would start by saying the shift that Germany has made and the need to pump more gas at the moment are short-term responses to what hope will be a relatively short-term crisis, and that if the war in Ukraine and the change in relations with Russia have taught us anything, it's that we need to move more quickly to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels. And here I'm not speaking only about Americans, but all of us and the growing numbers of us on the planet, as your first caller pointed out. It is also true, unfortunately, that the war in Ukraine and the lingering effects of the pandemic, which are still very much with us, may dampen prospects for the best possible outcomes in Egypt, but I remain hopeful. I think if anything, we have become more aware of the vulnerability of the planet to climate change. I think even in the United States, I sense a very significant change in the tenor of the debate about that, which gives me hope that we will act before it's too late.
And Dr. Hinzman, in about 30 seconds, your thoughts for what may come out of this recent COP gathering.
So I'd just like to say that, you know, I do agree with Ethel in that there has been tremendous changes over the years. There's been tremendous impacts on the people of the Arctic. However, I'd also like to point out there have been tremendous achievements, tremendous progress made in innovation and technological advances, in that we've developed better ways of making infrastructure more stable. We've developed better ways of mapping areas of vulnerability. We've advanced the science as far as understanding ecosystem changes. So there's been a lot of uncertainty with respect to the change and what those consequences would be. But also at the same time, you know, your scientific and your engineering communities are really responding to try and help make our communities sustainable in this period of change.
All right.
And I think, you know, it is a lot to do, but we are doing what we can.
All right. Thank you. We'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much to Dr. Larry Hinzman, Executive Director of the Interagency Arctic Research Policy Committee, Ambassador David Balton, Executive Director of the Arctic Executive Steering Committee, and earlier Dr. Alondra Nelson, the Deputy Director of Science and Society at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Thanks for listening today. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.